Yep. 16. Proverbs 10, verse 7. Yes, that one. 7. 7. I was 9 and 7. I had both in my head this morning. I, for whatever reason, kept going to 9. We've already done 9. Proverbs 10, verse 7. Let's pick up there. Somebody read that.
The name of the righteous is blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot.
There's like a competition. I like it. The memory of the righteous is blessed, but the name of the wicked will rot. I want you to think about the last funeral you've been to. We'll just start on a really depressing note this morning. Who has one in mind, good or bad or indifferent? What as you think about the last person's funeral that you attended, what was it like? What were they like?
Funeral, actually.
Okay.
It was my uncle's.
All right.
It's actually pretty fun.
Tell me about him. Do you know the Lord?
No.
Okay.
But he was a funny dude. So.
Okay.
It was sad, but it was just like, majority of my family are non-believers. So,
okay.
Like, he was a really funny comedy dude, so okay. All they did was crack jokes, yeah, they said. All
right. So. How about someone that's been to a funeral that you saw, like, a believer that's made an impact on life? And stories that were shared. Anybody have any one of those?
My coach in grade school. We were on a swim team, and he was struggling with cancer for, man, I don't know, a while, like maybe 10 years.
Hmm.
And he would go through a remission, and then it would come back in remission. And so it was just a fight overall. And then he was just a really genuine person. That would like give the shirt off his back to help the kids, and you just saw like at that funeral, they had it at a pool because obviously he was a swimming coach is what he was. They had it at a pool, and at that memorial, they expected a couple of hundred people to show up,
mm-hmm.
and they ended up having over 1,000 people show up to the funeral.
Mm.
It's so much that it inundated, like, traffic was just packed for the funeral. But the things that were there in hearing him, how he served and how he loved the kids and just that he had devoted his life to this particular art was monumental. But then for those who were intimate, and like were, you know, with him in the last months that he was here on earth, brought him to the Lord, and you saw like this change of like what he did and what he was known for to the speeches of like he is going to be in the forever presence of the Lord, and this man, if any man, you know, would deserve it, and you know he served, you know, wholeheartedly, and to have him, you know, be suffering in hell would just be,
yeah.
I mean, completely backwards. And so you just see like this shift as people came up and talked.
Yeah.
The funeral was incredible. Like,
but you're seeing a guy that's ultimately made an investment in people,
yeah.
and at the end of his life, there's a gazillion people there. Yeah. Anybody been on the back side of that or the other side of that? A funeral where it was just awkward? Alex?
Yeah, I did a funeral in Kingsburg. And it was one of those things where they're trying to put them in heaven. But I knew I'd walked with them the past couple, like, 3 months of the person's life.
Hmm.
I knew he wasn't a believer, but that everyone wanted him to be.
Hmm.
So yeah. It was awkward.
I did a funeral. It's probably been 8 years now. It was the most awkward experience I've ever been a part of in my ministry career. Not a question whether this guy was in heaven or not. Not a question. And his family hated him. I sat down in that room up there with the family and said, tell me about your uncle. And no lie, his nephew says he was an a-hole. Everybody in our family hated him. We're glad he's dead. Okay, so how do you as a pastor now get up in front of the 20-some-odd people that were at this guy's funeral? None of them wanted to be there. They're all coming for the food afterwards. And when you heard his life story, you're like, yeah, I think I actually hate your uncle too. Like, he was a... He was a bad dude, prison and other stuff. So, but you're thinking about, dude, at the end of your life, you've got zero friends. Nobody's coming to your side. The family that's there, that's kind of required to be there, right? Nobody likes you. So what do you do? What do you share? And it made me think about this proverb. The memory of the righteous is blessed. This isn't the memories that the righteous have. It's the memories of people that they have about the righteous individual. However, the name of the wicked will rot. In this world, there are two things that are going to outlast you and I. And the extent that we invest in those two things is going to be the extent that you're making your tombstone right now. I don't know if you thought about your life that way. I think we talked about a little bit of this concept before. But you're writing what's going to be on your tombstone right now. I don't know what was on that guy's headstone, but you know there was a birth and a death, and I don't know what his life amounted to in that dash, but it wasn't for much. Guys like this swim coach who made an impact in people's lives, guys that I sat at Harold Penner's funeral, if any of you guys knew him, to listen to the stories that were told about him, the impact that as a guy who's been dead for a year is having continually on his family is amazing. This guy lived an absolutely incredible life. And even some of the decisions that we see his family and even those around him making are because of the impact that he's had and the life choices that he made that are, they're around a year after he's gone, right? And he's celebrating with Jesus in heaven, but he's made an impact forever. So it's fascinating to me that that's the idea of this text. If you want your life to be longer than the day that you're dead and to make an impact past that, there are two things ultimately you're going to invest in. And that is the souls of men and women and the Word of God. And those two things will be here long after we're gone. And the extent to which you pour your life into those two things is the extent to which you're going to have an impact on people's lives. So it's obviously a great choice, a wise thing to invest in. Jim Elliot said, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." And it's the idea that I will willingly give my life away and serve the Lord and make my life about that. I am happy to give it away. And ultimately, I will gain what I can't lose, which is my salvation, my life. So giving my life away is where I'm going to find life, right? And we've seen our Savior say the exact same thing. So as you think about your life, and sometimes, man, that's what funerals are so good for, because they make you realize my time here is finite and it's going to be gone. What is my life about? What have I invested in? Is it the right things? Is it the wrong things? What are people going to say about me when I'm gone? Has my life been worthwhile? Okay, so in terms of the things that you know are making internal investments, the Word of God and the souls of men and women are where we would be wise to spend a boatload of our time. Okay? Thoughts on that depressing topic?
Well, I think also to just remember that, you know, it's not about what we leave here on this earth, but also what God has in plan or in store for us after. Like, this, our death is the beginning.
Yeah, it makes the toils and heartaches sometimes here a lot easier to handle.
When I was younger, my family had a lot of people that passed away. Just in my family and a lot of people that were close to my family. And every single one of those was a lot like what Joseph was talking about. You go up there and you see all of these people there for this person because of the impact they made on their lives, and they were all strong Christian people. And as a young kid, seeing the impact that those types of people have, it really shapes the way that you think about things. And I think that funerals are in a way strengthening other people as well, if you have that type of a life.
Absolutely.
You go up there and you have 2 hours worth of people just talking alone at the funeral, saying, and then this person did this and this and this, and you have that over tens of people. It really does show how
it's impacted the way you're going to live your life, right? Because you've seen that. That's an internal investment, right? Just at celebrating someone's passing.
And doing that even after you're gone, people can still talk about you and what you've done. It's really awesome.
It's good. Troy, Jordan, one of you guys had a thought back there.
I was just thinking about, I mean, even when I first gone through First Samuel, and we came across to Samuel's departure, and his kind of farewell address, his question, like, that we've gone over yesterday, right? You know, who have I done wrong?
Yeah. You know? It's a bold statement.
Yeah. I can't say that.
I ain't asking that question when I die. Anybody hear I wrong? I'm sure there's somebody, there's some... I lived 18 years as an idiot, so absolutely. So I got an ex-girlfriend that still won't talk to me because I was such a her to her and her family, so. Gosh, I'm waking up thinking about that sometimes. I'm like, I was such a butthole. Just, gosh, jerk. Anyway, thank you, Jesus, for grace and new life, because I was a jerk. All right, on that, 1 Samuel, let's meet a not jerk, shall we? Oh, Kyle, pray for us. Pray for us jerks and not jerks alike. Grace that we've been given.
All right. God, thank you for this morning that we get to learn from jerks and not jerks all throughout the Bible. Would you guide this time that we have this week? Now we get to dive in to see who this David character is, and just the work that you did in his life to prepare him for your kingdom. We love you, and we thank you for this morning, for this union. Amen.
All right. Well, I'm excited. This is a fun spot to be at in our journey. Obviously, you're going to fall in love with a lot of characters through the journey. I hope you fall in love with David. He's a neat dude. He certainly has his fair share of flaws, as we will see. But he's a good dude. Yeah, it does get better. So can you guys see that, Master Manos?
Sure.
I made it 150%. No, says Jimmy. You want 200? I'll give you 200. How's that?
I'll take 200.
I can read that.
All right. So just again to give us some chronology of stuff. So this chart, and I adapted this, obviously, as you can see in my notes up here, from a guy at DTS that had submitted this paper for ETS, Evangelical Theological Society, for those of you that are geeks and care about that, that are named Troy. The rest of us don't. And me. I'm kidding. But anyway, he talks about Saul's reign beginning at 21 to fit within really the grander scheme. It has a bit of conflict with one of the verses that we saw earlier. Maybe Saul was 30, but depending on how we read that verse. So, but anyway, just want you guys to see that. As we see Jonathan attacking the Philistines here later on Saul's reign. Saul's about 38 at that time. That puts Jonathan about 20 years old. So when we meet Jonathan for the first time, more than likely, he is a 20-something at that point. Okay, David, by the way, would have been 7 at this point when we're going to meet him this morning in 16, and he's anointed. He is a 12-year-old. Okay, some people would suggest as young as 8 when he is anointed king, which is about to happen. Okay, so he is a young kid, and we're going to talk through the significance of that. What I want you guys to see is the age difference between these three guys, or two guys, okay? This morning, as David comes on the scene as a 12-year-old, Jonathan's going to be 25. So we're talking about a 13-year age difference. So these guys are much more like mentor-mentee than they are best friends, okay? And that's going to play a significant role moving forward. I just want you guys to see the nature of that relationship. We don't see a lot of them in Scripture. This is a really neat relationship that these two are going to develop over time. And Jonathan is going to be the one that initiates this and makes it happen, okay? Which is a fascinating look at the mentor-mentee relationship as well. So often we think it's the mentees that are be going to the mentors, and I think maybe more of the opposite should be true. For those of us that are older, and we're all older to somebody, need to be seeking out young men and women saying, hey, man, I see something in you or whatever it may be, okay? So with that, 1 Samuel 16, okay, we've seen the kingdom now ripped out of Saul's hands. Samuel has promised that that's the case and how this is going to go down. And now 16, we're going to see the guy that God has had kind of waiting in the wings, okay, an odd character, somebody, again, that Israel wouldn't have chosen, but he's certainly a guy that God is going to choose. So I want you guys just to see in him qualities. David is a remarkable kid in a lot of ways. So 16, verse 1.
The Lord said to Samuel, how long will you grieve over Saul since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons.
All right, so we get a word from God to Samuel. Hey, how long are you going to be mourning over Saul? Which is, it's really cool that Samuel's that way. He's not mourning over Saul per se. He, I don't think, like, loves Saul. But he's mourning over the fact that we've got a bad king at this point reigning over Israel who's got no heart for God. So fill your horn, and you're going to go anoint one of Jesse's sons, Jesse the Bethlehemite, okay? Town of Bethlehem, for I have selected a king for myself among his sons, right? We see in 1 Samuel, is it 10? 1, Samuel anoints Saul here with a flask of oil. Jesse's son is going to get a horn of oil. So whether the size makes a difference or not, don't know. But the anointing process is going to take place from the prophet. Okay. Now this is a fascinating statement here in verse 2. Listen to Samuel's response.
Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me."
What? Like, does it give you a picture of how bad Saul is? That if Samuel came and said, "Hey, bro, you're fired. I've got a new guy for your job." Samuel is fearful of his life at this point. As a, how old? Let's just find out how old he is at this point. 92, okay, is how old our boy Samuel is at this point. Okay, so he's fearful that Saul will literally be so angry that his life would be in jeopardy. Not a good thing. Okay, and God says, here's what you're going to say. Keep reading, Kyle. Verse 2, midway through. We're going
slow. The Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord.' Invite Jesse to sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. And you shall anoint for me, him who I declare to you."
All right, so we see this is going to be God's plan. God's choosing this time. You're going to tell him there's a sacrifice. You're coming to that. You're not coming to fire him. So
God wants him to lie? No, I'm
just Verse 4, Aaron, keep reading.
Samuel did what the Lord said, and when he arrived to Bethlehem, the elder of the town, and when he met with him, they asked, "Do you come in peace?"
So my immersion says they came trembling. So why would they be fearful of Samuel showing up to your town? Like, what was the last story we just read? Dude, he just chopped a dude into pieces, right? So they're like, "Buddy, you're not screwing around. As a 9-year-old dude, you're not afraid to drop the hammer if God says drop the hammer." So he does. So they roll it down. He's like, "What's going on here?"
I think my professor mentioned that they might be nervous for another reason.
What's that?
And that is that something in this town has just happened, and they think he's aware of it, but they don't know for sure, so they're acting funny.
Did he have a suggestion as to what that funny thing was?
Yeah, Jesse was unfaithful to his wife and had a child.
Let's get there. Sit tight on that, okay? So, maybe, okay? That's an interesting hypothesis. My oldest and I were actually sitting in the truck on the way home from school yesterday talking about that. So he rolls into town. "Do you come in peace?" And he said, I have come in peace to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." He also consecrated Jesse and his sons, invited them to the sacrifice. So come, we come to worship. You guys can come with me. We're going to have a sacrifice. By the way, Jesse, you and your sons are invited to come to the sacrifice as well. Okay. Came about, verse 6, when they entered, they looked and Eliab, this is Jesse's oldest son, and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." Okay, so Jesse shows up. He brings his son, his oldest kid, by the way, of 7 boys, is Eliab. Okay, now question for you. You're Jesse, and you just got a word from Samuel that God is going to anoint one of your sons, you don't know which one it is, to be the next king of Israel. How many of your sons are you going to bring to the ceremony? You're going to bring one?
My favorite.
Your favorite. You don't know which one it is. He's going to bring all. God says, "I'm going to choose." You're not choosing. I'm going to choose which son I'm going to anoint. So Jesse, one of your sons will be king. How many are you going to bring? You're going to bring all, correct? And Jesse brings all his sons. Okay? Came about, when he entered, they looked at Eliab and thought, "Boy, this guy looks just like Saul. He's a firstborn, he's a natural choice, he's Reuben, he's got the skill sets," or whatever it may be. Externally, he looks the part of a king. And 7, God says, uh-uh. Alex, read that.
"But the Lord said to Samuel, 'Do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him.'"
Now, how do they choose Saul? By all those things, his appearance, his height, his stature, his external qualities, he's the guy. Sorry, keep going.
"For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart."
Boy, isn't that good? So we're going to see something initially with David that's very, very different than Saul. What happened over time as we continue to build above the waterline with Saul? What happened? What got exposed below the waterline with Saul? His character, it crumbled. He didn't have the weight underneath the heart to sustain the glory, the recognition, the status, the power that God had given him.
Why would Samuel, after just going through that whole situation with Saul, pick a king based on the same exact
I don't think Samuel is. The people thought that had been invited to the ceremony, surely that's the king. He looks the part. So I think there's this idea of we want another kingly king. The people want that, right? They're probably a little fed up with Saul, but he reminds him, man, we're not, I am not picking guy based on external appearance. I am picking guy based on his heart. So I that's my take. So I think Samuel's like, Lord, whatever you want at this point. Like, I don't even want to go. I don't want to die today. He's being obedient, okay? So mark number one that you see of Jesse's son that we're about to meet, what's he like? What does that tell you initially? He's a man after the Lord's heart, or God looks at his heart, and we'll see that description of him later, that he's a man after God's own heart. We've seen it already of him mentioned by Samuel. What does that mean?
Jesse?
What does it mean of David? As you're thinking through qualities of this king,
this guy's humbled, recognize who God is and who he is.
Yeah, he's at very, first, I mean, he's a follower of God. He's a follower of Christ. He's a worshiper, right? Alex?
I think in contrast to Saul, like, Saul's problem is that Saul thinks he can do everything without God. So in contrast to Saul, I think David relies on God more.
Yeah.
I think that's what it means, is he relies on him.
Certainly. Okay. So we're going to see this heart level come to the surface with David over and over again. Okay. And it's not that his heart's perfect. He has a wicked heart like the rest of us. Good morning. How are you? Can I help you find anything?
The women's Bible study.
Oh. It's at 9? You're way early. How are you?
6:30.
I think it's at 9. Is there a women's one at 6:30?
James.
Yep, mid-size. It's at 9.
Tuesday,
6:30
p.m.
Oh. It's 9:30. It's at 9:30.
Friday,
I run South
9 a.m.
9:30 this morning.
We're doing First Samuel. It's not near as fun as James, but, you know, whatever. So, enjoy your morning. Sorry about that. That's awesome. Oh, yeah. All right, so. Dude, seriously, showered and everything. Looks a lot better than all you guys, by the way. You quit showering and brushing your teeth and everything and show up at 6 o'clock. So. Look, all I said was you guys need to brush your teeth, man. Showers are completely optional, so that's fun. I understand. Clearly, I showered this morning. Can you tell? It's quite all right. Yeah. All right, we're good. Is that shirt clean? More or less. All right, so back to David. Focus. All right, so number one's out, Eliab, not the guy. So Jesse called now his second-born son, Abinadab, made him pass before Samuel, and the Lord said, neither has the Lord chosen him. So Samuel says, sorry, neither has the Lord chosen him. So we're 0-2. Verse 9, Jesse made Shema pass by, and he said, neither has the Lord chosen him. Third-born, nope. Thus, verse 10, Jesse made 7 of his sons pass before Samuel, but Samuel said to Jesse, the Lord has not chosen any of these. Really? So Jesse brings all 7 of his kids, all 7 of his male sons before Samuel, and God said one of his kids is going to be king, and none of them are king. Did God make a mistake? So what's going on here? So, what's that? Jesse may have made a mistake, okay? We'll see. Samuel says now to Jesse in verse 11, Kyle, read that.
Then Samuel said to Jesse, are all of your sons here? And he said, there remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep. And Samuel said to Jesse, send and get him, for we will not sit down until he comes here.
Huh. So Jesse's got one more son who's not present. And what is he doing? He's tending the sheep. So what's his occupation? He's a shepherd. Now, who does the shepherding in a family? We've talked about this before.
Women.
The women, okay? Now, if it wasn't the woman, who then would do it in a family if you didn't have sisters? The youngest son, okay? So that would be fitting, correct? Except for the fact that David has 2 younger sisters at this point. 2. He's the one doing the shepherding. So it's not like, hey, dang it, we don't have a babysitter. We're going on a date. You're stuck as the youngest babysitting the rest of the sheep, right? They had other options, but David, for some reason, is not invited to the ceremony. Does that strike you as odd? It strikes me as odd as well. So for whatever reason, he's not invited, and Samuel says, Well, I guess we're going to sit here, Jesse, until you go get him, okay? So he doesn't get invited initially. Yeah, we're not going to sit here. I guess we're going to stand. That's exactly what the text says. We're not going to sit. But we're going to hang out, okay? If you ruin my surprise, I'm going to shoot you. I'm kidding. I'm kidding.
No, I
Sean and I both studied under the same professor that taught me what I'm about to teach you guys, and it's just a fascinating view at Scripture that I went, huh, that's interesting, and you're really making my head hurt right now. So anyway, we're going to get there, and I'm going to make your heads hurt as well, I hope, okay? So here we go. Verse 12. Sean's going to speak in a minute. Not yet. He doesn't like getting shot. He sent now, verse 12, and brought him in. Look at David's appearance. Read that. Verse 12.
So he sent for him and had him brought in. He was glowing with health and a fine appearance and handsome features. And the Lord said, rise and anoint him. This is the one.
All right, you've got some interesting words. He was, how does it read? What text are you reading from, by the way, Jimmy?
NIV.
That's NIV?
Yeah.
Okay, read that again. Just this description part.
He was glowing with health.
Glowing with health?
Wow.
Okay. Anybody got a different word for glowing with? You probably don't even know what it is because it's so different. Ruddy. Mine says ruddy. What is ruddy? What does ruddy mean? It means red.
Oh.
So he's a red-headed kid. Okay. Can you get an idea? Like most redheads are pale, red hair, freckled, glowing with health, clearly. Okay. In Israel, is this normal?
No.
No. Okay, they are, generally speaking, darker complected, dark hair. This is not a normal Israelite kid, right? He's a bit of an oddity, right? Nothing wrong with that. And the text says he has beautiful eyes. Why are the eyes mentioned? Yeah, the eyes are the windows to the soul. Like, that tells you something. It's not just saying he's got pretty eyes. The eyes are a picture of... your walk with the Lord, it's a window to the rest of your body, right? So you guys remember how Rachel and Leah were described? Rachel was beautiful in form and face, but Leah was weak in the eyes. I mean, she's ugly, right? That's a nice way to say it, okay? So he's a good-looking dude. He's got beautiful eyes, and he's handsome in appearance. So it's not like he's ugly, but he's not the guy, again, as you compare him to Saul, there's no comparison. So ladies don't swoon over David, they swoon over the Saul. So that's kind of the appearance. However, what does God say in verse, what's that?
It's also 12.
This is true, yeah. So, good point. But at 12, in Israel, dude, that's marriage material, man. 13-year-old women, you know, had Jesus. So, woman, I should say, only one. Mary was probably 13 when she had Jesus. Just FYI. Think about that, right? We married in a different culture. It's a different deal. So, what's that?
I said, I wish my daughter would.
Have Jesus or get married or both?
Have Jesus at 13.
Okay, gotcha. Be good.
Even if it's Jesus, yeah. Going down.
Right. Yeah. Some boy's in trouble. Yeah, I can tell you what, man. My 13-year-old came home pregnant. It'd be... an interesting day. So, what do to say the least? Sean would be bailing me out of jail. Yeah, this is why I have some rich friends. So, not that Sean's a rich one, but yeah. I keep it short. None of y'all are helpful, right? I got 50 cents. Well, I got the late fees. We get $75. This is the kid, though. Arise, anoint him, for this is he. Now, again, I have to ask the question, why would Jesse have not brought David to the ceremony, knowing one of his kids is going to get anointed? He brought the other six non-firstborns, yes? He doesn't just bring Eliab, or Elishib, whatever his name is. He's forgettable. But he brings the other six. Why not David?
The redheaded stepkid.
Maybe he's the redheaded stepchild. How do you end up, by the way, with a stepchild?
By being unfaithful.
Yeah, you sleep with another woman. Your wife sleeps with another man. We don't know, but there's a fascinating text that you guys have read 100 times that I think speaks into this. Okay, so let's turn real quick to Psalms. Psalm 51. We've read this, I think, with theological lenses, which I don't think is incorrect, But I think David wasn't necessarily writing this with the idea of trying to prove a theological point that as Americans and in Western Christianity we make from this, that is a correct assumption. It's just not necessarily the text that we need to go there, okay? This is David's psalm of lament, okay, after being caught in his trespass with Bathsheba, okay? So he's writing a psalm after having slept with a woman that's not his wife and having murdered her husband. This is the psalm that David writes, okay? So it's obviously he's heartbroken, he's torn up, and he's finally come to a state of repentance, okay? So sorry if I just ruined the rest of the story of David for you. This is going to happen, okay? But here it is, okay? Verse 1, be gracious to me, O God, according to your loving kindness, according to your chesed, according to the greatness of your compassion, blot out my transgressions. I've sinned, God be gracious to me. Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity, cleanse me from my sin. I know my transgressions, verse 3, and my sin is ever before me. He is confessing sin. He's heavy. He's burdened, okay? Against you and you only I have sinned and done what is evil in your sight. You are that you are justified when you speak and blameless when you judge. So we're speaking of specifically David's sin is sleeping with another woman, right? And killing that woman's husband. And he's asking for forgiveness. So that's the context. Verse 5 now. Here's the verse that you guys have all heard before. Somebody read verse 5.
Behold, I was brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me.
Now, when we talk about that verse as American Christians, what is this verse talking about?
Sin.
Yeah, it's talking about the idea of indwelling sin, of sin being passed down, Genesis 3, right? I was brought forth in sin. I have a sin nature, right? I came out of the womb sinful. I don't need to do anything to be a sinner because of the seed which I come from. I'm a sinner, okay? That's right, okay? That's total depravity. That's all well and good. We believe that here. However, is that what David's talking about here? Maybe not. What's the other way to read what David just said?
I've literally been brought forth from a sin that my mom had.
Yeah. There was a sinful relationship that gave birth to me. I was literally brought forth in iniquity, and in sin my mother conceived me. I mean, he's talking about the very process of conception was sin. So if this is the case, and David's mother slept with someone other than Jesse, had an affair, and now has a kid, who is that kid to Jesse?
Nobody.
He's a nobody. The language we would use in America is he's a bastard kid. Like, you're the result of my wife's affair. You're not my son. These are my sons. These are the ones that God will choose from. You can stay home and take care of the sheep.
Dang.
I'm not positive that's the case, right? But that is certainly a possibility. Given Jesse's actions in this text, you go, could it be? Maybe. I remember hearing this in seminary one day. I was like, what? Literally lost my mind in the car ride home with all the guys I rode with who were debating it and just literally mind blown and frustrated. So, anyway.
Well, it can prove to be like, I don't know. I could jump over that train. But it's like, you think about it and you read through that, and if you put your theology in the Bible, yeah, you can see that as like inherent sin.
Yeah.
But then that would be bad exposition because if you look back into his story, it's like, no, you see
yeah.
his
yeah. The exegesis of this text as opposed to the eisegesis of this text, everything we're talking about leading up to verse 5 is about sexual sin,
yeah.
David's. And then he says, man, I come from a line of sexual sin. My mother, that's how I got here, man.
Wow. But it makes sense that God would do something like
that. Yeah. Yeah, doesn't God love that? Yeah. Like, yeah, let's pick that kid. Let's take the kid that's born, right? Like, that's so God.
Can we look at his genealogy?
We know he's from, we don't know. That's it. We know he's Jesse's son.
Can we look at Jesus's genealogy? Because doesn't that, like, point back to...
Well, he's still Jesse's son, whether Jesse wants to admit he's his son. So he's still from Judah, and he's still going to be the line. So as you point all the way back to the first Judah, he fits in that line. But he may have gotten in an odd way, kind of like a Ruth.
Or Rahab.
Absolutely.
I suppose it wouldn't matter either way, but if it was Jesse who had slept with someone else, would he then take responsibility for that child as opposed to his wife having slept with someone wouldn't the man then be responsible for that child?
Yeah, maybe in a practical way. In a biblical way, I don't know. I'm not sure how that would work. I think, yeah, there would be more onus on him. That'd be kind of like the Judah Tamar situation where Judah sleeps with his daughter-in-law, right, and still has to take responsibility for that kid, those sons. But certainly on a practical level, you're going to feel much differently about that kid when that's somebody else's sin that got you there and their oops. So, anyway. Jordan, you had a thought.
I'm looking at the genealogy. He's got a list.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, go to Matthew 1 or whatever. So, yeah.
I think the one aspect that isn't necessarily seen or understood here is this is a Middle Eastern culture. You've got the second most powerful man in the nation who just showed up to your house. For you to have left a family member in an Asian culture, Middle Eastern culture, out in the pasture was of significant embarrassment and I guess thumbing.
Yeah.
Whatever.
It's on a ton of levels. It speaks of something else that's going on beneath the surface that's not explicitly mentioned in the text. That's not normative, right? And I think as Americans, even on a practical level, you're like, dude, if someone showed up tomorrow and said, "Look, one of your kids is going to be president of the United States," how many kids are you bringing to the party? Like, all. I mean, that's obvious. Unless you've got a kid that you don't claim as your own. You're maybe hiding, maybe that's the deal. Maybe he's, Sean said, maybe is the town knows that something is amiss, and in a town that size, maybe that spread, right, of, oh gosh, he heard about Jesse's wife, she got knocked up by someone. So, you know, like, that's a scandal, right? And maybe they're trying to hide, who knows?
The expectations, though, it's like, yeah, man, God's going to appoint his man for king. It's like, who's this little shepherd boy? He's pretty artsy. He likes to play his little harp.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
He's a warrior.
Yeah. you know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. He is not what any of us would pick, right? Not at all.
In regards to his appearance, what would be the geographical location of his upbringing? Like, is he Irish?
Why does he look like your wife? I don't know. Yeah.
yes.
This one doesn't fit. I don't know. Like, why would he be redheaded? And I don't know. It's a great question. Whether he's an anomaly or speaks to who the dad was, I would imagine. I don't know. That's a great question. But he's a different looking kid. He stood out amongst the kids of his family that were probably all darker haired and darker complected. So they looked Jewish. So, anyway, fascinating. Okay, so just, you know what, I'm not going to take a bullet for that, but I think it's certainly very, very possible why David is sitting at home with his two younger sisters tending sheep. So, did you go yet? You said brilliant things. Say brilliant things, Emily.
No, I'm good.
You good? You sure? We waited so long, you just got mad at me and said, forget it. All right. All right, so there you go. Okay, so back to 1 Samuel 16. So we see this this potential, like, in David's life. But this is the guy, verse 13 now. Samuel then took the horn of oil, anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward, and Samuel arose and went to Ramah. So he's been now anointed king. He is the guy. He's 12 years old. And Samuel goes back to Ramah, his hometown, where he's been ministering out of. And David, we're going to find out, goes back home as well. He's going to go shepherd sheep. He's going to go do what he's been doing since day one. Okay, 14 now. Let's pick up there and let's see kind of what's going on in Saul's life at this point.
16:14?
Correct.
Now the Spirit of the Lord gathered... The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul, and an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him.
There's some theology for you. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. We've seen this much before. And an evil spirit from the Lord terrorized him. Say what? Yeah, how about that? So can God use whatever means necessary to bring about his will? Yes. So can God allow evil to occur to bring about what ultimately he wants. Yes, and here's a text that says it. Now, God isn't the originator of evil. We've talked about these concepts before, but will God allow these things in people's lives in order to bring about what he wants? Yes, and can and does and will. Verse 15, Saul's servant said to him, behold now, an evil spirit from God is terrorizing you. They don't have any problems with that. They get where it's from. Let the Lord now commend your servants who are before you. Let them seek a man who is a skillful player of the harp, and it shall be when the evil spirit from God is upon you that he shall play the harp with his hand, and you'll be well. Okay, so let's find someone who can play music, right? And make you relax, and when that happens, then the evil spirit will go away, you'll calm down, whatever. That's their idea. So Saul says to his servants, provide me now a man who can play well and bring him to me. Great, that sounds wonderful. I need some elevator music. That's wonderful, okay? And look, by the way, who they choose in verse 18.
Then one of the young men said, behold, I have seen the son. Jesse the Bethlehemite, who is a skillful musician, a mighty man of valor, a warrior, one prudent in speech, a handsome man, and the Lord is with him.
Good night. I mean, here's a laundry list of ridiculous. Let's just pick them apart, okay? So they go, oh, hey, wait a second. I know a guy who can play the harp. I know a guy, a son of Jesse, the Bethlehemite, who's a skillful musician. What does that tell you about David? This is David, obviously, we're speaking about. He's got a reputation of being able to play a harp. Yeah. From Jimmy's world, yeah, he's got time. He's put some hours into it. When you're a shepherd and you've got nothing to do, I'm sure there's a lot of downtime. So he's playing a harp. It's probably something that just brings him enjoyment. This isn't some spiritual gift that he has. God is taking something that he's developed in him, a physical gift that is going to be used for God's glory, right? It's one of those fascinating concepts of even the... Talk about the idea of there's no wasted motion with God. Like, why is David a skillful player of the harp? I mean, he's learning the harp. Do you think he's got some great end game in this? Like, he's like, I know God's going to use this for his glory. Probably not. He's probably like, no, I just enjoy playing the harp, right? It's fun. I enjoy it, whatever. And God's going to use this to open a door for David to come now before Saul. Fascinating picture. So the physical gifts that you guys have, the non-spiritual gifts, but the talents that you have, those may open doors for you, right, that are unique to you, that you're great at, that will get you in before great men, great women. So you never know what God's going to use to get you there. And for David, it was his ability to play the harp, of all things. Now, this guy isn't just some emo kid that is a musician and that's it. What else do you see about David mentioned right next to this ability to play a harp? A mighty man of valor. What does that mean? Yeah, he's not just a musician. He's tough. How would you find out a 12-year-old kid is tough? Why would you know that?
The way he handled those sheep and take care of them, from protecting them from bears and lions.
Oh, my. thank you, Stephanie. You got that. Lions and tigers and bears.
There you go.
But that's the idea. David's had a chance to prove himself. Lions and tigers and bears, oh my. You with me? Yeah. What just happened?
You guys ever heard, I want to go where the wild things are?
Wild things are? That's a great book, too. See? Jimmy's like offended now. All right. Bring it back. But he's a warrior as well, right? He's proven himself in the field with sheep. Like Jacob talked about this idea. Like, man, yeah, when Laban, your sheep were attacked at night, I defended them, I kept them. So David not only is a skillful musician, but he's also he's proven himself on the battleground, if you will.
When it says that, sorry, I'm going back. When it says that an evil spirit was like tormenting Saul, does that mean he was like possessed?
Influenced by, probably the same idea of the Holy Spirit that comes to bless and then is gone. It doesn't indwell permanently, mm-hmm. But yeah, somehow is the logistics of it I don't get, but possesses the idea of, you see that in the New Testament where spirits or demons are cast out and called out of. I think this is more on than in, if there's a differentiation to be made. So yeah. Okay, so he's a mighty man of valor. So David is he's his training ground, his practice field has been taking care of sheep, and God has given him skill. So you see valor, you see, man, he's tough, he's not fearful of the job that God has given him, though that's a hard job. You're seeing these qualities. You don't often see this musician-athlete, musician-warrior balance in a kid, and David has that. Okay, what else can he do? You see it on the backside. A mighty man of valor, a warrior. Okay? He speaks well. What does that mean? One, prudent in speech.
He's probably polite, kind. He's probably
bargaining. Yeah, he speaks well of his elders. He's personable. He can shake someone's hand and look him in the eye and say, "Nice to meet you, you know, Mr. Hoonover," or whatever. He's a good kid. And he's well-spoken. Like, man, we got kids in our house all the time. And some of these kids are absolute knotheads. They don't know how to have a conversation with an adult. I'm like, what are you teaching your parents? I tell my kids, if you ever go to someone else's house and you behave like that kid that was in our house, please don't ever let me hear that, right? You better be able to say, Mr. and Mrs. Johnson, thank you so much for having me over. I really enjoyed my time. Or, gosh, thank you for dinner. Or, be grateful. Learn how to interact. Learn, God forbid, how to ask an adult a question, right, and engage with them. And you can figure out a kid within 30 seconds of being in their presence what type of home life they live in by the way that they interact with people that aren't like them, that are different from them. Man, can they interact? Are they all kind of self-focused in me world and playing on their whatever device? I mean, it tells you a ton about how their parents have reared him. Jesse seems to, at this point in life, have reared this kid to be a good kid. He's a genuinely good kid, okay? And he can speak. And he's a handsome man. Oh, by the way, so he's 12, 13, and the Lord is with him. God is blessing his life, right? So nothing spectacular has happened. He got anointed to be the king of Israel, and what does he do? He goes back home to the job that he had the day before, and he's tending sheep, and he's doing what God's called him to do.
I mean, pure speculation, but do you think Dad, even though he doesn't consider him a son, might have said, you know what, now that you've been anointed by the most powerful man, maybe we should invest in your education a little bit more or something?
Potentially. He's maybe 6 months to a year older. In chapter 17, when David fights Goliath, by the way, he's going to be a 13-year-old. So we're not talking about a ton of time that's passed. So this is, right, mind-blowing. The disciples, by the way, were 7th, 8th graders. They're not grown men. So as you think about who Jesus picked, man, my youngest daughter is almost old enough to be a disciple of Jesus, right, in that culture. You're talking about sophomores, maybe the oldest in that, other than Peter, but the rest of them were young. Some people say John was maybe 9. That's just the culture that was that you would pick disciples from. That was normative. So we have this idea, these are bearded 20-year-old men, right, that are following Jesus around. Unlikely. Could be, but very unlikely given the culture. Okay, so again, everything happens much younger. So, fascinating picture of this guy. So, verse 19, watch this. Saul sent messengers to Jesse and said, "Send me your son David, who is with the flock." Why is that telling of David, Stephanie? What do you see in that?
He's still working
on the anointing. Yeah. Where does God call you out of when you're working? Current faithfulness. David is doing what David's been called to do today. I'm a shepherd, but I've been anointed king. I know, but this is the job that you have today. This is your role within the family. God will call you out of current faithfulness. God very rarely blesses people that won't be faithful with little and then gives them much. Haven't we heard something in the New Testament about that? He was faithful with little, will be faithful with much and be entrusted with much. But he who can't be trusted with little is certainly not going to be entrusted with much. So if you don't do a good job, David, shearing sheep, cleaning up poop, feeding your animals, like, man, this is your testing grounds. Can you do what you don't like to do on a rough day? Can you do the things that don't give you maybe great pleasure or are difficult? Or you got to wake up early in the morning and stay awake at night or go chase down some sheep that broke through the pen again? And David's about that. That's what he does. So God calls him out of current faithfulness. Even though he could play the bigwig card with his brothers, I'm the king of Israel, you know, you go feed the sheep. I'm a big deal. That doesn't go to his head. So you see a kid that we're going to learn has a lot of depth of character in him. Okay, Jesse took a donkey, loaded it with bread and a jug of wine and a young goat and sent them to Saul by David's son. What is Jesse doing here as he sends now at the request of Saul, his son David? What else is going on in that picture? Gifts. Why? Yeah, because he's going before a great man. You don't come empty-handed, right? This is your first impression. So as David shows up to meet Saul, he brings gifts. And his dad is the one that says, man, David, you need to bring these.
Does Saul know that he's not actually?
You get this really bizarre... Saul is still very much the king. But he doesn't have a clue who David is.
So, he's like, David's just waiting to get old enough to be king.
Kinda, yeah. There's a sense that...
job until David's ready.
Exactly.
It's literally like blanky.
Yes, in a sense. It is very similar. So, Saul's still the current king. And by the way, David's 13 at this point. He's going to take the throne at 30. We've got 17 years before David's going to get the throne. Think about that in your life a little bit, okay? God makes you a promise and says, you will be this, and then waits 17 years to fulfill it. I mean, how many of you guys have been around long enough to think through those ebbs and flows of life to think, well, God, this didn't happen today, and it's been a week, God, or gosh, I've been waiting for a month, and 17 years. What do you think, by the way, that journey is going to look like for David? I mean, here's a great kid. He's got a good heart. There's so much to like about him. Do you think God's just going to take him like it's going to be like this rocket ship trajectory to greatness? He's going to crush David. Crush him. Even this good kid, even this kid that was reared right, even this kid that loves the Lord? Absolutely. Because David has crutches. David has things that he leans on when times get hard that are not God. And before, as we talked about with Moses, before God can use a man, he must first break him deeply. And David is going to get hammered by God. All for his own good. It's going to be painful. It's going to be difficult. But he's not ready to be king. He does not have the maturity yet. He doesn't have the depth of character yet. He's got a great start. He's a good dude. But God has to work out in him some things first that don't happen with prosperity and being a king. And that's what happened to Saul, right? We took this kid from the fields or wherever Saul was at that time, he was a shepherd as well. And what happened? We immediately gave him the spotlight, go rescue the men from Jabesh Gilead, you're the king. What happens? Man, in a decade, he's crumbled and we're left with the Saul that we have now. And he's going to reign for another decade. And he's a nightmare, okay? So God's working on him. But remember that. God calls you out of current faithfulness. God calls me out of current faithfulness. Be faithful where you're planted, bloom where you're planted, and then let God remove you from there when he's ready to uproot you and take you somewhere else. But that's God's business. You do what you've been called to do today. Do you have a thought, Troy?
Oh, no.
Yeah. Cool. So, he comes with gifts. Verse 21, David came to Saul, attended him, and Saul loved him greatly, and he became his armor bearer. So the idea is, what has David now become to Saul? A servant. He's the king. Not today. I'm a servant to Saul. Saul's the king. And you're going to see David has incredible regard for Saul because of the position that God has him in. He doesn't like Saul, but he's kind of like, it's kind of like the office of the Pope, right? The Catholics see that is infallible. The guy that's in it isn't infallible, but the office is. David's going to say, listen, there's something about that office because God put him there that is special and is unique, and I need to regard it with tremendous care and respect and honor and dignity, even though the guy that occupies that office is going to try to kill me next chapter, two chapters from now, doesn't like me very much, is a moral meltdown, is evil. David can see those as different. So David becomes his servant. And what happens? What happens when a guy like David is in your life? How does Saul see this guy? He loved him. Why? Who doesn't love a servant, right? What can I do for you? How can I make your day better? Saul, what gifts do I have that I can lend to you that would... Mike, who wouldn't love that guy? Of course, you see immediately that David's a lovable guy. Saul loved him greatly and made him his armor bearer. What does that mean? Carry my heavy shield. Here's my spear. When I go into battle, you're going to attend me, right? David's not necessarily the warrior, but he is a servant of Saul and says, man, hey, why don't you come with me into battle, right? Take my stuff and then Run back home, right? But he becomes exalted. So Saul sees this guy, and what does he immediately want to do? He wants to exalt him. He wants to give him a raise. He wants to give him a promotion because he's a great kid, okay? 22, keep reading.
Saul sent to Jesse saying, "Let David now stand before me, for he has found favor in my sight."
Okay, so keep rolling.
So it came about whenever the evil spirit from God came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him.
All right. So you're going to see that this relationship continues so much to the point where Saul's going to say, "Man, I don't want David on a per diem basis. I don't want him to come just when I have an issue." He's going to send to Jesse and say, "Man, I want to hire him. I want him in my presence continually. I want him to live in my palace." Palace, right? He doesn't have a palace yet. But I want him to be in my home all the time because I want him around. He's that good. And again, this is David just being David. He's using his natural gifts, being a good dude, and he's been ushered before literally kings.
He's probably the only redhead kid bouncing around the king's palace at this point.
Certainly.
He's just more funny.
He is an oddity in so many regards. So, absolutely. Okay. All right. So, we've seen David's introduction. 17, you guys are all very familiar with. This is the story of David and Goliath. Okay. So, God is going to give this kid instant fame, instant success, right? As a 13-year-old boy, again, as you look at our chart, David is in 1 Samuel 13, or 17 rather, 13 years old, okay? So let's just read that story with this in mind. This is a fascinating view. Again, I mean, we want to paint David as older and bigger, and he's just not. 17:1, let's pick up there.
Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at
Sukkah.
Which belongs to Judah, and they camped between Sukkot and
Azekah. You guys have seen that town before? Remember Azekah? I showed you guys four cities: Gezer, Bet-Shemesh, Azekah, Lachish. Okay, Azekah was one of the gateway cities to Jerusalem. Very important deal. So if you wanted to get to Jerusalem, you've got to get through Azekah. And even before Jerusalem is the capital, this still is a place that you wanted to defend. Okay, this was the only route in, one of four, basically from the west into your territory. So they're fighting a battle in the Shephela at a gateway city. So you guys know the spiritual nature of that. Okay, so the idea is you've got Saul camped on one side and his men. You've got the Philistines coming from the other side, and they're camped against each other. They're both on kind of a mountain side, rolling hills, right? And then in the middle of this is a big ravine, okay? The Elah Brook. And in between, this is Azekah Valley, or the Elah Valley, rather, is where the battle is going to take place. So it's not a huge piece of land. We go there every year when we go to Israel. Really cool place. But there's a battle that's about to ensue.
I feel like you said this a lot, but is it customary for a king to go to battle?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. Especially when you're Saul, because that's why they picked you. So yes, Saul definitely should be battling. You see that in Troy mentioned it, 2 Samuel 11, it's in the spring when the kings would go out to war. What does David do? He stays home and sends Joab and says, "Dude, you're a machine. Go fight my battles for me. I'm gonna stay here and watch TV and hang out on my roof." In this day and age, absolutely. Our presidents used to go to war, right? I mean, that's how a lot of guys got elected, because they went to war and they were bad, and they had it very different than today, right? We used to put warriors in the presidency. Now we put politicians there. So maybe that's part of our problem.
I was gonna say the whole season for fighting is a real thing.
Mm-hmm.
I had two separate deployments, both to the exact same area. And the first time we were there from like August through October. Heavy fighting.
Mm-hmm.
We were missiles, rockets, gunfire every night, fireworks. It was unreal, true war. We went back and hardly a shot was fired, and we were there from September through April, all the way through the Christmas time. It's so cold.
Yeah.
The ground is so hard.
Yeah.
People don't farm. People don't do anything. Yeah. Everybody's indoors trying to, like,
stay warm,
and stay warm and stay out of it. In the summertime, they all come out and battle.
Yeah.
So it's a seasonal thing.
Yeah.
Because
bizarre.
It's the only time you'll survive the elements outside.
Yeah. Unless you're just, like, crazy. You think through some of the wars that were fought in World War II. You guys ever seen Band of Brothers?
No.
You guys have to watch that. The Battle of Bastogne and some of the conditions that those men had to survive in winter without proper clothing. Man, it's amazing. So, yeah, there literally was a season. Nobody wants to go fight when it's unpleasant. You got to go camp out, as does your enemy, right? So there's a mutual agreed upon, like, yeah. So
it's kind of crazy, though, that during World War II that Russia may have lost some of the battles that they had because they attacked at the wrong time in the wrong terrain.
Interesting, yeah. I'm not a super big World War II buff, but those stories are good. So anyway, so they're off to war, okay? They're going to battle against the Philistines, their common foe. Saul and the men of Israel, verse 2, gathered and camped in the Valley of Elah, drew up in battle array to encounter the Philistines. The Philistines stood on the mountain on one side. Israel stood on the mountain on the other side with the valley in between them. Okay, so the stage is set. You've got a valley, you've got one troop on one side, one on the other, and you're not going to see this battle take place, okay? Here is the guy that we're meeting in verse 4. You all heard of him before. Read that.
Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath, from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span.
6 cubits and a span. Anybody got a note on how tall that is?
Yeah. Approximately 1 cubic is 18 inches. So 18 times 6.
9 feet, 9 inches. Now think about a guy that almost has to duck walking underneath the basketball hoop. Okay, he hits his head on the net, just walking under it. Okay, and he's 3 inches shy of smacking his head on the rim. Okay, that's a tall dude. This is a 9 foot ceiling. Yeah. So his head sticks through the tie. I mean, it's a big dude. Okay, he had a bronze helmet on his head. He was clothed with scale armor. Okay, the armor of a warrior, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze. Anybody got a note on how much 5,000 shekels of bronze is?
Really heavy.
Probably 175 to 200 pounds. So he has a full-grown man in armor weight strapped to him. 175 pounds. Well, the armor would have been, mostly chest, but down as well. But chainmail, that type of idea. But it's... that's a lot of weight. So this is a big boy if he can carry that much armor, okay? He had bronze greaves on his legs, bronze javelin slung between his shoulders. The shaft of the spear was like a weaver's beam, and his head, and the head of the spear weighed 600 shekels of iron. So just the head of his spear that he would hurl weighed how much?
15 pounds.
Yeah, I've got a note, maybe even up to 25 pounds. That's a bowling ball. The heaviest bowling ball that you're going to pick up is 16 pounds. You ever picked up a 16-pound bowling ball? Can you imagine hucking it like this? Not like this. I mean, and these guys are warriors, right? So if you get hit by that thing, you're getting impaled. Like, no doubt, okay? His shield carrier also walked before him. He stood at the ranks of Israel and says now to them, this is fascinating, why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and your servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. So Goliath walks down their side of the mountain, down to the Elah Valley, and says, bring a guy from up in your side. Choose for yourselves a champion like me that he'll come down and meet me. What's going on here? What's this picture? This is an odd battle description.
Well, he's challenging anyone to come and win the war man to man.
Yeah. This is a strategy that you would often employ. So you take your best person from your army, and we'll take our best person from our army. They will fight together, and this will be symbolic of the winner. So instead of having mass casualties, we're going to take our best versus your best, and whoever wins, wins. And the other army forfeits or now becomes servants of the other. That wasn't an odd way to fight battles. We're going to see that again in Israel. That's a normative process. So it just so happens that the Philistines have a guy from Gath who's giant, and he looks like a battle-hardened dude. Now, Saul's a big guy, but Saul ain't this dude, right? Saul's 6 foot whatever, 200 whatever pounds, but he is not 9 foot nine. He's not carrying a spear that is 20-plus pounds in weight. I mean, this is a big dude. Okay? And this is what he says in verse 9. Okay? This is what I just told you guys. If he's able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us. Okay? Again, the Philistine said, I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man that we may fight together. So who would you expect to come and fight Goliath?
Saul.
That's his job. He's the Benjamite, right? He's got skills with a sling. He was picked because of his military prowess, his features. This guy looks the part of a king. So you would expect a king to come and fight. Verse 11.
When Saul and Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid.
So where's Saul? Similar to the Saul we saw in 1 Samuel, what was it, 6 or... Nah, maybe 10 or 11 when he's hiding in the baggage, right? Saul's nowhere to be found. Like, lo and behold, man, he's in his tent drinking out of the igloo, right? Just he doesn't want any part of this battle, okay? Now, back to the story, verse 12.
Now David was the son of the Ephraite of Bethlehem of Judah, whose name was Jesse, and he had 8 sons. And Jesse was old in his days of Saul and advanced in his years among men. And the 3 older sons of Jesse had gone after Saul to the battle. And the names of the
all right, so they're forgettable. So he's got 3 older sons in battle, right? Okay, and we won't read through all those.
And David was the youngest, and now the 3 oldest followed Saul. But David went back and forth from Saul to tend to his father's flock at Bethlehem.
So you get an interesting note on like David's role now. Goes to serve Saul, comes back home, does his job, shepherds sheep, goes back to Saul, serves Saul. So he's back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. His 3 oldest brothers, however, are in the army. Okay, so they're old enough to fight battles. Now, watch what's happening here with Goliath.
The Philistine came forward morning and evening for 40 days and took his stand.
The idea is he says the same thing every morning. Bring somebody to come fight me for 40 days. And what does Israel do?
Pass.
Yeah. Okay. Now, Jesse now sends David once again, verse 17.
Take your brothers and ephah of his roasted grain and 10 loaves and run to the camp of your brothers. And bring also 10 cuts of cheese to the commander of their 1,000. And look into the welfare of your brothers and bring back news of them.
So tell me how they're doing and feed them. So go take a delivery. Okay, so Bethlehem to the Elah Valley. This is it's a day's journey there. It's long, but you're going to go through a ravine. It's not something you couldn't have done in a day, but it's a significant distance, and he's carrying a bunch of stuff with him, okay? David rose now early in the morning, takes the supplies that his dad had given him. He's an obedient, good son. He comes now, in verse 20, to the circle of the camp where the army was going out to battle, in battle array, shouting the war cry. The Philistines, in verse 21, drew up in battle array, army against army. So David just happens to roll in as Saul is coming, or Goliath is coming out making his daily announcement, like, hey, why don't you guys send somebody that's tough and can come fight me? So David left the baggage in care of the baggage keeper, verse 21, runs to the battle line and entered now in order to greet his brothers. As he was talking with his brothers, hey, how's it going? Dad wants to hear how you're doing. Behold, the champion, the Philistine from Gath named Goliath, was coming from the army of the Philistines, and he spoke the same words, and David heard them. The same thing that he's been saying now for 40 days. All the men of Israel saw the man, they fled from him, and were greatly afraid. 25, the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who is coming up? Surely he is coming to defy Israel. And it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. So, where was Goliath when we first saw him in verse 8? He was coming down his side of the mountain. Now where is he? He's crossed the ravine and he's coming up into Israel's camp. He's saying, nobody will come out. He's defying Israel. He's getting closer every day and closer and closer. One dude and nobody will come out to fight. This is humiliating, right? And when he comes out, what does everybody do? They run back to their tents. And this is embarrassing, okay? And Saul is so scared, he's made an offer saying, man, whoever defeats this guy, what's he going to do? I'll make you rich. I'll give you my daughter as a wife. And I will make your father's house free in Israel, meaning no taxes. This is a pretty sweet offer, right? And it's going to be appealing to David. And many people have given David a hard time about this battle that's about to ensue, thinking, man, this is what his motivation is. Okay, I don't think that's the case. I think there are some sweet perks to what's about to happen, but I don't think that's necessarily David's motivation, okay? So David just now shows up, and he says in 26, what is this to be done with this man who kills the Philistine and takes the reproach away from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should taunt the armies of the living God? Now, I want you guys to take note of this. This is much bigger than just a battle between Israel and the Philistines. What is Goliath saying that would cause David to say, who is this uncircumcised Philistine who taunts the armies of the living God? He's challenging God. So Goliath is proclaiming in the names of his gods, Dagon and the like, my God that I serve is bigger and better and more powerful than your gods. And David's like, whoa, 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 whoa. This isn't just about Saul and this guy having a, you know, a one-on-one and the glory goes to one of these two guys. This is about Israel and the Philistines. And greater than that, it's about Yahweh versus Dagon. Like, this is a spiritual battle. And David's insulted hearing, and it says later on that Goliath cursed him by his gods. Like, he's hurling insults about Yahweh and in the name of Dagon, insulting David and insulting who David worships. So David sees this as much bigger than just a battle. It's a spiritual battle. Again, they're in the Shephelah. It's a perfect picture of what would happen here, okay? And obviously, as of right now, the Philistines are much that are winning the day, right? Where are we? I about skipped like an entire page. I about went to 46. Thank you. All right, so they tell him this is what's going to be done. Now, 28, he's going to have an interaction with his oldest brother. Okay, and this has got to be, you can imagine, there's a little bit of tension between these two at this point, right? The oldest brother was supposed to be king. Look at this in 28.
Now, Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he had spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger burned against David, and he said, why have you come down? And whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your insolence and your wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle.
I mean, that's a pretty stinging commentary from your oldest brother. Why have you come down? Okay, so what is your motivation, David? Why are you really here? With whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? What is that speaking to? Shepherding. Not only are you a shepherd, but like you don't even have a lot of sheep to shepherd. Like, you've got the least and the last job that, by the way, your sisters should be doing. Yet they're not, and you don't even have a, right? It's insulting. And then he just says it. I know the insolence and the wickedness of your heart, for you have come down in order to see the battle. And the only reason that you're really here is maybe the offer that you've heard from Saul. You want glory. You want riches. You want fame. You want honor. You want money, right? And Eliab says, you're wicked. And David, verse 29, this is his response.
What have I done now? Was it not a question?
So, okay, dude, I was just asking a question. What have I done? So you see a response, but then he moves on. Was I not just asking a question? I was just wondering what, you know, the deal was. So it doesn't seem like David's getting overly defensive here. He moves on. He turns away from him. Doesn't battle back and forth. I think there's some maturity to be said with David here. He goes to another and says the same thing, and they all answered him as before. I mean, the king is going to reward the person who does that, right? And David doesn't feel this need to defend his character, to defend his motives with his older brother. He walks away. So there's some wisdom there, I think, okay? When the words which David spoke to him were heard from Saul, he sent for him. Verse 32, David says to Saul, listen to this in verse 32, let no man's heart fail on account of him. Your servant will go and fight the Philistine. So here you've got Saul, the king of Israel, who's in his 30s, and you've got David, a 13-year-old boy, saying, I'll go do it. Like, David, you're not even old enough to be in the army, man. Like, your three oldest brothers are here. You're a little chump kid, and you're saying to Saul, I'll go fight him. And this is Saul's response. It's almost laughable, right? Verse 33.
You're not able to go against the Philistine to fight him. For you're but a youth, while he has been a warrior from his youth.
Yeah, so, I mean, he gets laughed at by Saul. Like, bro, that's so sweet, right? Like, that's literally the kind of the commentary. Oh, buddy, that's so nice. Go back home to Jesse, right? Tell him your brothers are fine. You can't do this. But when you were, he's been a battle hardened guy. Like, man, since you came out of the womb, bro. Like, this is not going to work. Now, I want you to notice David's response. Boy, tell me if this doesn't say something about this kid.
David said to Saul, your servant was tending his father's sheep, when a lion or a bear came and took a lamb from the flock, and I went after him and attacked him and rescued it from his mouth. And when he rose up against me, I seized him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has killed both a lion and a bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine will be like one of them, since he has taunted the armies of the living God.
Dude, this guy is freaking bold. What does he see that God has been doing in his life? What is he able in that moment to recognize? Yeah, dude, God's got this handled, and all this stuff that I had no idea what God was doing. Shepherding sheep in the wilderness, and yeah, there's an issue and a scrum, and man, now I've got to rescue a sheep from a lion's mouth, and I've got to kill a sheep, right? All of this was leading up to this moment. And I didn't know why God was doing what he was doing in that moment, but he doesn't listen to the words of Saul. He listens to what God has been doing in his life and recognizes this. Charles Swindoll writes a series of books. I'm in the middle of Moses right now. Character studies of people in the Old Testament. He's done a ton of them. And on his work on David, I want you to listen to this. This is a fascinating observation. He says, "So often, when facing our own giants, we forget what we ought to remember and remember what we ought to forget. We remember our defeats and forget our victories." Isn't that good? And he says, in that moment, David could have chose to listen to Saul and say, yeah, you know what? I am small. I am young. I am insignificant. I've never fought a real battle in my entire life. I've never done any of this. But David remembers his previous victories, right? I would guess a guy like David is probably a journaler as well. He's probably recorded somewhere for him some type of monument or whatever God's past faithfulness. And he has the ability in that moment to draw upon those memories and say, God took care of me here, and God's going to take care of me here. God's given him no guarantees. God has not spoken to David and say, go fight Goliath. I will be with you. David just sees an opportunity and he steps up. And so many of us in that crucible, we fail because we listen to the wrong words. We choose to listen to Saul as opposed to what God's story in our lives is. And he steps up as this 13-year-old kid and says, look, Saul, I can do this. And it's not me. God has done this in me. And you're talking about this guy who's taunting our God. He sees God's glory at stake. This isn't about his glory. This isn't about David's name. That he is able to step up and see that in the midst of it. And that's what makes this guy pretty remarkable as a 13-year-old. Okay? So, amazing. So, Saul is so, like, okay.
Continues and says, "The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear, and he will deliver me from the hand of the Philistine."
Yeah, thank you.
Saul said, "But go, David, may the Lord be with you."
Man, like, that's
bold. And Saul clothed David with his garments and put bronze helmet on his head and clothed him with his armor. And David girded his sword over his armor and tried to walk, but for he had not tested them. David said to Saul, "I can't go in these, for I have not tested them."
Can you imagine what that looked like, a 13-year-old boy in Saul's armor, right? You ever seen your kids play dress up in your clothes? I mean, that's exactly how it looked like, right? It's just, it's like, man, I don't fit. I can't use this, but he's very polite. I haven't tested these. So what is David going to go with? What would you guess? What is his occupation?
Shepherd.
He's a shepherd, and he knows how to sling a rock with a sling. That's his instrument, and he doesn't wear armor. He doesn't wear a helmet. Like, he's going to go with what he knows, what God has done in him, his natural gift. So he does as he's leaning on the Lord.
Have you seen the Bible series? I'm not sure if you ever watched that.
Mm-mm.
Okay.
I've heard of it. The one on the History Channel?
Yeah.
Do they do this one?
They do a little scene from David. It was actually really cool.
So David says, thank you, but no. Okay. In verse 4, watch what he does. He took a stick in his hand, and chose for himself 5 smooth stones from the brook, the Elah brook, put them in his shepherd's bag, which he had even in his pouch, and his sling in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. So he takes what he knows, his sling, and he takes some rocks from the Elah brook, okay, and puts them in his pouch, right? So he comes as prepared as he can, and now he has an interaction with Goliath, okay? Verse 42, When the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. Can you imagine Goliath? Really? It's been a month and a half, and that's the best you got? You're sending out a 13-year-old boy who hasn't even finished puberty to come fight me? Are you kidding? Does he even have facial hair? Like, this is insulting to Goliath.
I'm just going to imagine the picture of him having, like, really long, wavy red hair, and it's like, it's like, what?
Yeah, just a snotty-nosed kid, right? It's just, it's humiliating to Goliath, right? And the Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the sky and to the beasts of the field. Like, buddy, you're going to be a meal for vultures and, you know, animals. You're going to be dead, so bring it. And David said to him, this is great. You come to me with a sword, a spear, and a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the armies of Israel, whom you have taunted. This day the Lord will deliver you up into my hands. I will strike you down. I will remove your head from you, and I will give your the dead bodies of the army of the Philistines this day to the birds of the sky and to the wild beasts of the earth, and all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and all the assembly may know that the Lord does not deliver by sword or spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hands. Goliath, this has nothing to do with you and me. This has to do with your God and my God. And you have spent too much time insulting my God, and I can't have it anymore. I mean, you see a walk with God in David that he is willing to lay down his life for because of the honor that he has for him. And he just has this idea that God's going to show up in situations like these. So, it happened when the Philistine, verse 48, arose and came near to David, that he ran quickly to the battle line. David put his hand into his bag, and from his stone, and slung it, struck the Philistine on his forehead, and the stone sank into his forehead, so that he fell on his face to the ground. By the way, this chapter is 58 verses long, and we get two verses on the battle. And one of them is David running to the battle line. Like, it's not even the battle, it's pre-battle. We, in a sense, get 49. That is the entire battle. Isn't it bizarre what we focus on, and the text focuses on? It's not about the battle. It's about God being taunted by this this Philistine who thinks his gods are greater. That's the story. And David is just, he's just a sideshow. He's just an instrument to be used. But what's at stake here is Dagon going to win or is Yahweh going to win? And none of you will defend the glory of Israel except David. So, fascinating picture, okay? So, you guys know the story. He wins the battle. He takes what he has, this sling. So, he obviously is smart enough to keep a distance from Goliath. That's his only advantage. Hand-to-hand combat, up close, David's a dead man. But at a distance, David can win that battle as a thrower of the sling, okay? David prevails with the sling, the stone. He struck the Philistine, rather, in verse 50, killed him, but there was no sword in Goliath's hand. This is great, okay? He now ran and took over the Philistine, took his sword, drew it out of its sheath in verse 51, and killed him. So he finishes the job, if you will, or at least impales him again. And he cuts off his head with his own sword. So David beheads Goliath with Goliath's sword. When the Philistines saw that the champion was dead, they fled. So their entire hope was in this guy. And now David's one action is going to turn the momentum of the entire armies. Verse 52, somebody pick up there.
The men of Israel and Judah rose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and the gates of Ekron.
Where's Ekron? It's on the coast. So what has Israel done to these Philistines? They've pushed them back into their land. Okay, about time, exactly. Gath, Ekron in verse 52. Keep going to 53,
and
Joseph.
And they slain Philistines that lay along the way of Shoreham, even to Gath and Ekron. And the sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps.
So man, Israel wins the day because of this one kid's actions. One person can change the entire tide of this movement. And it just took David having the courage and the ability to think, man, God can actually show up. Okay, in 54, this is pretty cool.
Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his weapons in his tent.
So you would bring the head to show Saul, you know, or whomever, like, we've defeated that. So this is a bit of a trophy, if you will. And it's a sense that, yeah, God won the day. But what has he done? What does he do with specifically the sword of Goliath? Yeah, why? What is that? Yeah, and in a maybe not in, in a negative sense, but it's an Ebenezer. It's a remembrance of God showed up this day, right? This is my journal. This is my monument. So when I doubt that God can do it again, I just need to remember this moment. And that you can see David's life has been built on that. Listen, I was out in the wilderness by myself tending sheep, and that was the only option I had. Either I show up or my sheep dies. There's no one else to come to the rescue, and God's done that. You wonder if David's got a bear claw, right, or a lion's tooth or something in his, like in his, yeah, or just maybe an arm, you know, in a box somewhere that he just remembers God's faithfulness in his life. Pretty cool.
The sword must have been huge.
You can only imagine, right? Can you imagine wielding that thing? More than likely, right? It's probably a pretty big deal, okay? When Saul saw David, this is fascinating, go out against the Philistines, he said to Abner, his commander, "Abner, whose son is this young man?" Saul has no idea who this dude is. So though he loves David and loves him ministering to him, he's a servant, and he's one of many that Saul has. He's forgettable, okay? He has no idea. And the armor bearer said, "By your life, O king, man, I don't know either. Like, I don't know who this guy is." And the king said, "You inquire whose son this is. David returned from killing the Philistine. Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand," which is hilarious, right? This 13-year-old kid's walking. Just flies at his hand, right? Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" He's just killed Goliath, and Saul can't remember his name. And David said, this is fascinating, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. My dad is your servant, and I'm your servant." Like, this is the king of Israel talking to the former king of Israel, if you will. And David says, "I'm your servant. My dad's your servant. That's who I am," right? No glory for him, not, "You don't know who I am. Man, I'm a big deal. You know, I kill lions. I kill Goliath." There's none of that with David. There's no, what's that?
I thought he knew who he was.
He does, but Saul's got a bunch of servants, right? Like, he's just not
there.
He's using David. He doesn't care about David. He performs a task, and then he goes home. "Carry my shield. Go home." But he's forgettable. So, cool picture. So, 17 is, it's fascinating to me that God gives David just this instant success, and boy, David is about to, he is on every news channel in Israel, right? He's on the front page of every newspaper, so to speak. Everybody is singing his praise, right? So instant success, rocket ship success initially, and then God is going to slowly whittle away some things in David that he needs to do to make him a man that ultimately is going to lead a nation. But he's not there yet. This is not God's long-term trajectory of David's life, and probably isn't of yours either. So be encouraged. You have some Goliath moments like this that you need to celebrate and remember, but there are days that are going to come that I assure you David doesn't want to even get out of bed. Okay?
I like what I remember.
You got 30 seconds. Okay, cool. All right.
What was the significance in the scripture that he took 5 stones, not 3 stones or 8 stones?
You know.